Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we enter the world of books, and I'm pleased to be joined by our book reviewer, Nancy Pearl. This time, actually, in studio, as Nancy returns to Tulsa to give the OU Tulsa Seed Sower Lecture this evening. Nancy began reviewing books for us some 22 years ago as a Tulsa City County librarian, now is world known as America's Librarian. She's the former executive director of the Washington Center for the Book in Seattle, author of 6 books in the Booklust series of books about books, editor of Booklust Rediscoveries, a series devoted to reprinting some of the best and now out of print novels from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And of course, you can hear her from time to time on NPR's Morning Edition, as well as NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, and of course, right here on Studio Tulsa. She'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Perkins Auditorium on the OU Tulsa campus on the pleasures and perils of a life of reading. It's a part of the OU Tulsa Seed Sower Lecture Series. Now, the event is free this evening, but seat reservations are recommended, and you should visit tulsa.ou.edu for information on that. Nancy Pearl is our guest today. Nancy Pearl, welcome back to Tulsa and welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Richard. It's good to be here.
To be here in body as well as voice, disembodied voice.
Person, but I remember when we were standing up to do this.
That's right. Well, the things have changed over 20 years.
I think so.
Well, absolutely. You're here in Tulsa to do a lecture for OU Tulsa on the pleasures and perils of a life of reading.
Yes.
Are there perils to a life of reading?
There are perils to a life of reading, but I can't give any away. But let me say that they are very serious perils of a life of reading. And so to undertake a life of reading, you know, you're risking.
I would think,
much is at risk.
I tell you what I've always admired about you is the fact that it doesn't matter how many crappy books you read, you're always expecting the next time you open the next book up to be transported somewhere wonderful, and I think that's a great attribute.
It's getting harder and harder to do that though, and to believe that. And I've come to realize when I think about why there are so many more days that I kind of grumble around the house and can't find anything to read, and you know, start a book and just dislike it intensely, and yeah, where are all those wonderful books that I've just loved that have meant so much to me over my life? And I think that where those books are is where they've always been. That is, good books are being published. It's just getting harder and harder to find them amidst the kind of dross that is surrounding them with not very good books.
That's a really good word, dross.
I know. When's the last time
you
heard
that? Well, the other thing I would think is as you age and as you read more, you become more discriminating. Now, do you find when you go back to a book that you thought you loved 30 years ago and you go, oh, well, this is not as good as I thought. Is that part of becoming a discriminating reader?
I think that what that reflects is that we all read a particular version of every book we read. We all read our version of the book. And Paul Auster, great writer, novelist, essayist, talks about how in his books, in his fiction, he always leaves space for the reader to contribute to the book. And he says in this one essay, he says, and in the end, I fully believe that the finished product is a collaborative effort between me and that individual reader. So when I go back and when I think about a book that I love, for example, Paul Scott's great, great, great quartet, the Raj Quartet, I mean, I would give anything to go back and read that for the first time.
Now.
But I can't. I mean, my mind is so colored by those feelings that I had about it at that time. And it's so unlikely that you can, you know, what's that phrase? You can't step in the same river twice. That's true with books. Every time you read a book, you're a different person and you're bringing different aspects to your reading.
What I find a lot of times is that I'll read something I read 10, 20 years ago, and in some ways it is not as good as I remembered it, but there's that memory of reading it the first time that, okay, so that sentence and that little section was a little clunky or it didn't ring authentic.
Right.
Still, the memory of it overall makes it still an enjoyable read.
I think that what I'm finding now is rereading a lot of books published in the 50s and 60s, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, all the social attitudes, how quaint that was, that we all felt that way at that time. And if you read a book published in the 1950s or early 1960s with these sort of 21st century, right, 22nd century, the 21st century attitudes, it puts a little different spin on it. In some ways, you have to sort of forget about cell phones and where you are now, mm-hmm. and go back. And I've been just so involved the last few months in rereading World War II, Cold War spy fiction.
Le Carré.
Yes, because we're reprinting for the Booklust Rediscovery series David Quammen's book, The Soul of Victor Tronco. And The Soul of Victor Tronco is, just as Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is the book about the Kim Philby affair, the great betrayal in MI5 and MI6. I believe that David Quammen's The Soul of Victor Tronco is the novel about the great scandal in the CIA under the counterintelligence chief, James Jesus Angleton, when he destroyed the agency trying to find
the
Russian agent.
Yeah, the moles, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And so this is the story of that period. And so I always loved that book. I discovered it when I was working at Yorktown Alley Bookstore. I bought the book at that time and still have that copy.
Well, that's great that you're being able to republish that. Let's talk a little about that, this whole rediscovery series. What's the vetting process? Are these all very personal choices for you?
Yes, and these are totally personal choices. These are just books that I loved and that I totally so regret that new generations of readers haven't been able to find them. And The Soul of Victor Tronco is a great example, because it fits so wonderfully. I mean, if you're a fan of John le Carré, if you're a fan of Len Deighton, if you're a fan of Charles McCary, so you have two Brits on the one hand and Charles McCary, American writer, and you see, and there's David Quammen's The Soul of Victor Tronco, and no one's read it. I mean, I think the only people that I know...
I've never heard of it.
I know. The only people that I know who have read it are people that I've lent it to and then sort of stood over them, you know, anxiously waiting for them to read it so I could take it back, because you can't, it's very hard to find copies. So, that's coming up. And the one that's coming out very shortly, we just finished doing the final cover, is a terrific novel set in Montana, in Missoula, Montana, in the 1930s, called The Girls from the Five Great Valleys. And again, you know, these are books, many of these books are books that I found when I lived here in Tulsa, and would go, before I even worked at the bookstore, when I would go to the East Second Library, that's mm-hmm. where I found the Elizabeth Savage, the Girls from the Five Great Valleys.
Now, is that a Montana writer?
She's a Montana writer. Uh-huh. She wrote books both set in Montana and set in the East Coast. She and her husband were both novelists, and he especially is taught in the English department at the University of Montana, because he's a real Montana writer. And she, too, just brings alive place for her as a character in her novel. So doing those reprints has just been really great fun.
Now, I'm interested in the books that you're attracted to. You say you've been reading so much from the 50s and 60s. That's sort of the time you were, you know, coming of age.
Right.
And I wonder if we're always attracted to that period that, you know, we came from, that was sort of not necessarily childhood, but, you know, early adulthood, adolescence.
Well, you know, they
and when you sort of develop that reading habit.
Well, and they say that the music that you love is the music that you heard as a teen, you know, as a teenager. And the music that I love is the music that I heard in college. And I still, that's still my favorite kind of music. So I think the same is true of books. But we're doing, when the adult series finishes, and Soul of Victor Tronco is the 12th, and then we're doing a 13th only as an ebook. All the rest are both in print and ebooks. But the 13th is a terrific novel. When we had a chance, even though it was just an ebook, I really wanted to do it because I just wanted to be associated with it, called The Cheerleader. And it's coming of age in the 1950s. Mm. And what a great book. What a terrific book it is.
Now, are these selling well?
Well, you know, I don't pay attention to that.
They keep asking you to do it, it's all right.
I mean, you know, but as soon as we finish these, I think nobody did it as a moneymaker. It's not going to make, I mean, I remember my agent was asked about it, and she said, no, she's very plain spoken and wonderful. And she's, nobody's doing this for money. Do you know how much money I'm going to make on this? Enough to have lunch in New York. And that's that. So it's mostly that I just want these books out there. They have wonderful covers. I've had lots of, I'm so fortunate to have input into the covers. And now we're doing 2015 through 2016 will be a dozen children's books that we're reprinting. Again, yeah. My favorites, beginning with a picture book called Not This Bear, about a little boy who dresses up in a bear suit to go visit his Uncle Julius.
My guest today is Nancy Pearl, our book reviewer here at Studio Tulsa, and she'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at OU Tulsa's Perkins Auditorium. But let's talk about books. What do you got for us today?
Well, a wonderful, wonderful narrative nonfiction that I just could barely bring myself to put down is a book by Mark Harris, and this is his second book. His first book was called Pictures at a Revolution, and it's the story of a narrative history of the 5 Academy Award-nominated Best Pictures for 1968. And so, you know, cast your mind back.
I'm trying to think what was 68.
Dr. Doolittle.
Oh, my gosh.
Was one of them. And he goes into just all the context, the background, the context, how people were getting along on the making the movie. And reading it is such a pleasure. And you finish your reading of, I finished my reading of that book with really wanting to see those Best Picture nominees again. But Mark Harris's new book, which is just out and would be a wonderful, wonderful Father's Day present or Mother's Day present that's coming up too, for anyone who loves film and loves good writing, is called 5 Came Back. And it's the story of the five major Hollywood directors who went and fought in World War II. And were there filming during major battles, like the Battle of Midway.
So John Ford.
Frank Capra, John Huston, George Stevens. And it's arranged not by director, but chronologically. So you see what everybody was doing at a particular time. And George Stevens, and what happened when they came back and how the war influenced them and what they were doing in the future and how it changed them. And George Stevens was there when finally the conquering armies were allowed into the concentration camps. And he filmed, I think it was at Bergen-Belsen. Mm. And his film that he took there during the trials were part of what brought that tragedy and crime home.
Really? So he was the director that he actually filmed the Nuremberg?
He filmed material that showed at the Nuremberg trials.
Right, right.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And you can imagine what that was.
Now, there had to have been a profound influence on him.
Totally.
Now, I'm thinking of somebody like John Ford, who is such a tough, gruff old guy.
Right.
I'm not sure. But when you think about his films in the late 40s and early 50s, they're a little more nuanced.
Yeah, and I think that I think that each of the Harris goes into each of the directors' beliefs. You know, this was a time when the motion picture people, you know, the big studios were primarily run by Jews, and that was not something that was popular, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism, and many of the, you know, actors like Kirk Douglas changed their names.
Yeah, it's like self-denial.
Yeah. And so there was this very iffy attitude toward the war. And then they got into it, and they're just amazing stories, And again, I finished this particular book wanting to see so many films. And the first film I watched was Swing Time, which is the first Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers film. Because, you know, these people went from, a lot of the directors went from these less nuanced.
Yeah, frolicky movies.
Right,
movies.
Or totally good, totally bad, you know, to these more nuanced films. So that's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book. Just what narrative nonfiction should be.
All right, that's Mark Harris. What do you have next?
Well, next is a collection of short stories published by a very small publisher called Bellevue Literary Press. And Bellevue Literary Press, their tagline is something like, where literature and medicine intersect. And one of their books, Tinkers, which was a terrific novel, won the Pulitzer a few years ago, a well-deserved Pulitzer Prize went to that author. And these are books that get, you know, when I talk about hidden treasures, I'm always trying to find these hidden treasures. Mark Harris is not a hidden treasure. It's a treasure, but it's out there. You're going to find it on the front tables of Barnes & Noble and things like that. But the Bellevue Literary Press, those are hidden treasures. And so Tim Horvath's understories is, Tim Horvath is what I call an elastic realist. So his novel, his stories are set, they're rooted firmly in reality, but that reality can stretch like like a rubber band. It's very elastic. It's not set. And so great things, weird things, odd things can happen in his short stories in the context of reality. So when you think about Tim, when I think about Tim Horvath, I think about writers like Borges, Italo Calvino, or more contemporarily, a writer named Kelly Link, who just is one of my favorite short story writers of all time. You know, I flew in without a book, so I don't have a copy of Tim Horvath's understories. But there's a wonderful section where these kids are trying to, they feel that their mission is to help eradicate the problem of extinction among animals. They believe they have to train the animals not to get a free ride to have us take care of them, but that those animals have to manage their own lack of extinction themselves. He says it much better, but you know, anyone who could come up with an idea like that.
Now, so are these pretty broad stories in the collection?
They're broad in the sense that they're going to take you to all sorts of different places, some of them made up. There's a wonderful, the longest story, the novella, if you will, in there is set in a department of umbrology. And umbrology is not, as you might think, umbrellas, but an academic department of umbrology studies shadows. And you sort of want to like Google it and say, where are these departments of umbrology? Because when you think about shadows, you think of all the different ways shadows can be studied, like the shadow puppets, for example, mm-hmm. the shadow world of espionage, mm-hmm. Art, the shadows in art, what the importance of shadows in art. So this is an interdisciplinary department. And I mean, what an imagination. So that was just a delight to read.
And the book
And the book is called Understories.
All right. What's next?
Well, next is, I just have to talk about the novel Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, which just won the National Book Critics Circle, a well-deserved win, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Best Fiction this year. And it's the story of a young Nigerian woman who comes to the United States for college and her experiences as a non-American Black. And when the author herself talks about this book, she describes it as being about love, hair, and race. And for me, the most interesting parts, well, I bought into the book, Hook, Line, and Sinker. I mean, this was just a book I thought was fabulous. But what was especially interesting was thinking about race and race relations and thinking about what it was like for her, for the main character, to come here. And she comes not considering herself Black, because in Nigeria, you're not defined as Black. You're defined by your tribe.
Right.
And so she would think of herself as an Igbo or you know, whatever her tribe was. But to come here, her defining characteristic is her Blackness. And she writes a blog about non-American Blacks, what it's like. So, you know, I think those things about race. There's also a parallel story when her Nigerian boyfriend emigrates to England and his experience there. You know, it's one of those books, I thought it was wonderfully written. For me, it was the best novel that I read.
And of course, that absolutely rings true. I just had a guest on, John Rosengren, who writes baseball books. And he writes these baseball books there's a social history attached to it. He wrote a book about the incident where Juan Marichal clubbed John Roseboro over the head in a game in 1965.
Wow.
And so it's exploring their discrimination as they come up well after the color line had been broken. But what Juan Marichal, who was a fairly dark-skinned Dominican, came, it was the same experience.
Right.
He'd never thought of race at all. It was strictly class in the Dominican Republic.
Right.
And he comes here and all of a sudden he was totally at sea because he'd never thought about the color of his skin before.
Yeah.
And this is an American experience.
It is. It is. And it's so good for us to read and look at ourselves in a different way and ask ourselves why it's race that we're focused on and why not something else. And Adichie in interviews has talked about class. Class is a big distinction for her as well as tribe.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of book that opens up the world,
well,
I think.
I know most of the time the big winners of the year is you're going,
right.
I don't know. But this sounds like this is a book that you really were unexpectedly surprised to see won a major award.
I was. And the nonfiction that the National Book Critics Circle awarded for the best work of nonfiction, it was also my favorite work of nonfiction this year, which was called 5 Days at Memorial by Sherry Fink, which we talked about.
Yeah, we talked about Christmas.
About the results of Hurricane Katrina at a hospital. And both of these books are in paperback, or Americana for sure is in paperback. Sherry Fink's is probably coming out in paperback shortly. Great books for discussions because they both raise such interesting issues. And Sherry Fink's really, it talks about ethics. It talks about the decisions that we have to make as a society so that the doctors and nurses in these tragedies, which you have to feel are coming faster and faster, closer and closer together, are going to have to work with. I mean, one basic question is, in a tragedy, you know, what does triage mean? Who do you save first? Do you save the youngest who are most likely to survive? Do you save the oldest?
Who might be the worst off?
Who might be the worst off?
Yeah.
And just how prepared are hospitals? I mean, this hospital was totally unprepared, even though they had been through a hurricane already 5 years or whatever before, and knew that Katrina was coming. And, you know, are big places like that, are they ready for these? I mean, I live in Seattle where there's going to be an earthquake. And, you know, I'm getting ready to call up the hospitals and say, you know, do you have an emergency plan in place that really works? Have you checked your generator? You know, because those are all things we just take for granted.
Absolutely.
And you know, and then there's a wonderful novel that just came out a few months ago by Brian Peyton called The Wind Is Not a River. And this is a historical novel that is set around the only battle that the Japanese fought on American soil. Do you know where that is?
It has to be the Aleutians.
It is the Aleutian Islands. And the main character in this book is a newspaper reporter whose brother has been killed in the war, and he decides to follow, he's in Seattle, decides to go up to the Aleutian Islands, not to find his brother, but to understand what's happening. And he kind of disappears there. We see what's happening to him, but his wife, who is left in Seattle, does not. And she maneuvers herself very cleverly to the Aleutian Islands to try to track down what's happened to him. So it's a great historical novel. It's, you know, and no one has written, or very few. I don't know anyone.
Probably
else.
A local historian has written about the Aleutians.
Yes,
yeah, right. Exactly.
But you know, there was, and we never think of the Japanese being during World War II being on American soil, and yet they were.
Yep.
And so this is a book. It's just beautifully written, a really good historical novel, wonderful characters, and again, I guess the books that I like always kind of open up a little bit of the world for me, and this book certainly did.
All right. Well, we'll be back in touch with you in the summer with some great summer reading ideas. And we want to remind folks that you can see Nancy Pearl tonight at 6:30 at OU Tulsa. She talks about the pleasures and perils of a life of reading. And as always, we appreciate you being here, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
America's librarian and our book reviewer here on Studio Tulsa, Nancy Pearl, speaking with us. She'll be giving the OU Tulsa Seed Sower Lecture this evening at 6:30 at the Perkins Auditorium on the OU Tulsa campus on the pleasures and perils of a life of reading. The event is free, but seat reservations are recommended. You can get more information at tulsa.ou.edu or call 918-660-3220. For more information on the Book Lust series of books by Nancy Pearl or her Book Lust Rediscoveries, you can visit her website at nancypearl.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS. If you'd like to check out Nancy's picks or look at some of our previous programs, you can do that online at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa. You can look through our archives, or you can also look at this program for a list of the books Nancy talked about. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.